Hi, everyone, and welcome to a Juno Afternoon. I'm Andy Klein, your host on this Friday. Today we're going to be talking to Susan Conrad, who's going to offer us a preview of her Mendenhall Glacier Fireside Lecture happening tonight, all about her kayaking trip throughout the entire Inside Passage. We're also going to be hearing about the Success In and Out program from Ben Brown from the Juno Arts and Humanities Council. He's also going to give us a preview of the Queeby Sisters concert coming up. We're going to talk to an awesome group of students from Gassineau Elementary School about their efforts to encourage people to use paper rather than plastic straws. That's all coming up. We've got Bird Note, we've got music, and more. All ahead, right after National Native News. Stay tuned.
With National Native News, I'm Daisha Eaton in for Antonia Gonzalez. Top Department of the Interior officials visited Alaska this week to speak with local interior employees in Fairbanks about lease sales in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Their appearance touched off a hastily organized protest of about 50 oil drilling opponents at the Fairbanks Library. Edward Alexander, originally from Fort Yukon and the co-chair of Gwich'in Council International, was at the demonstration. He says the biggest concern is the porcupine caribou herd, which is central to the Gwich'in traditional diet and culture. The herd gives birth in the 1002 area where drilling is planned.
If this herd is harmed by having oil extraction efforts in their calving grounds, our communities are going to really suffer.
Joe Balash with the Department of Interior told the Anchorage Daily News that in March, the agency will take the first step toward the permitting process. Interior officials also traveled to two northern Alaska Inupiaq communities, Kaktovik and Utqiagvik. Miles of impassable roads to the polls, disputes over identification, and lack of native language ballots. Those are all barriers to voting that representatives of the Native American Rights Fund are hearing from tribal officials and members. NARF is in the final weeks of a series of listening sessions around the country to document voting problems by Native people. NARF Voting Rights Fellow Jacqueline DeLeon says the hearings are also to document some success stories.
We've had several tribes that have made voting a priority in their communities, and the way that they've gone about it is to make it a collaborative, collective event, as a result have really increased registration and ended up with remarkable turnarounds. One tribe had, 20%, and then the next election had 70% turnout.
DeLeon is in Albuquerque for a listening session at Isleta Pueblo. NARF attorneys are scheduled to hold sessions in Sacramento and Tuba City, Arizona in April. The 2018 Iditarod is underway in Alaska. The only Inupiaq musher to win the Iditarod, John Baker of Kotzebue, isn't racing this year, so it now falls to other Alaska Native competitors to bring home the championship. KNOM's Davis Hovey reports from the trail.
Fewer than 10 mushers out of the 67 competing in this year's Iditarod are Alaska Native. One of them, Yupik musher and longtime Bethel resident Pete Kaiser, would not commit more than 300 miles into the 1,000-mile trail to say whether he would be the next Alaska Native to win since John Baker.
I don't know, it's hard to know. We're definitely giving it our best shot.
Kaiser has 4 top 10 finishes in his 8 Iditarods. He's also won the Kuskokwim 300 4 times. He figures it's harder for some who live in smaller rural communities to afford the Iditarod.
Oh, it's a really expensive sport, so kind of have to have all your ducks in a row, and it's really not a hobby or anything else. It's a lifestyle, and it requires my time 365 days a year.
At last update of the leaderboard, Kaiser was running in 12th position with 14 dogs. Musher Mike Williams Jr. of Akiak agrees that the cost is prohibitive for some Alaska Natives, but despite that, Williams sees more and more Native people mushing in his hometown.
Back home, there's more young mushers starting teams and racing, and that's a really good feeling and good to see. And as far as Iditarod goes, it doesn't look like there's a whole lot of Native mushers.
Since he was a boy, Williams has been training sled dogs with his father, Mike Williams Sr., who has completed 15 Iditarods, his last one in 2013. The first musher in this year's Iditarod is expected to cross the finish line in Nome as early as Monday night. For National Native News, I'm Davis Hovey.
And I'm Daisha Eaton.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
We Are All Related is the theme of the 7th Biennial Vision Maker Film Festival, returning to Lincoln, Nebraska, April 20th to the 26th. Info at visionmakermedia.org. Vision Maker Media is proud to support this show. Support from AmeriCorps Vista, whose members fight against poverty while earning money for college and gaining skills, with rewarding service opportunities around the country, and info at AmeriCorps.gov/Vista.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Pick up where you left off. Complete your bachelor's degree with the Finnish College Alaska Initiative. Designed with the flexibility of online learning, it's college that fits around life and work while earning a degree in business, education, liberal arts, social science, and more. The University of Alaska Southeast is now offering a 3-credit tuition waiver for eligible applicants. Apply now for the fall semester. Learn more at finnishcollege.alaska.edu.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. Andy Klein with you today, and Susan Conrad has joined me in the studio. Susan, thanks for coming in.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Andy.
You've got the Mendenhall Glacier Fireside Lecture happening tonight. 6:30 and 8 o'clock are the two lectures, right?
Yes, two shows tonight.
And you are going to talk all about your adventure of kayaking the Inside Passage. So tell me about when did this happen?
I did this trip in the spring and summer of 2010.
Okay. And what possesses a person to decide they're going to solo paddle the Inside Passage?
Right. Yeah. The why.
Right.
I get that a lot.
Sure.
Lots of reasons. You know, the spirit of adventure, of course,
sure.
And that potential challenge of self-discovery. And part of it is that colloquial, because it's there,
mm-hmm.
you know, the Inside Passage is somewhat of a holy grail for today's sea kayakers. It was for me anyway. It's considered to be one of the most scenic and challenging paddling routes in all of North America. So that was, you know, definitely a lure for me. But, you know, I wanted to see how I would handle adversity. I wanted to challenge myself.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to experience the magic. I'd never been to Alaska before, so it's like, heck, I'll just paddle there.
There you go. So what was where did you start?
I started in the southern reaches of the Puget Sound in Washington State. So essentially began the journey paddling through the San Juan Islands and then crossed over up into British Columbia and essentially paddled the entire British Columbia coastline and then crossed over into Alaska and paddled into Juneau. Juneau was my final destination,
yeah,
so it's really poignant to be here.
Yeah. Have you been here since?
Yes. I actually I'm a presenter on one of the cruise ships that come into town frequently in the summertime. So it's really an honor to speak on the cruise ships and share this journey on a much larger vessel.
Yeah.
Pretty much the same waters that I paddled. Very similar.
A little higher up.
Yeah, it's a lot easier, I tell you. A lot cushier.
Sure. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, so how long did the journey take you?
It took me 66 days. It was just shy of 1,200 miles. 66 days on the water.
You start in spring or?
May 5th, Cinco de Mayo.
Okay.
The day that I launched.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the trip. So the British Columbia portion of it, how long does that take versus once you get into Alaska waters?
Yeah, that's a pretty good chunk. I'd say that was probably almost two-thirds of the journey because it's about 700 miles in British Columbia and the remaining very short distance in Washington State. And so the remaining, 400, 500 were in Alaska.
Okay. I somehow wasn't quite aware of that really the big chunk of it is going to be really going along British Columbia, yeah.
Yeah.
And is that a much different environment than once you get into the Inside Passage, you know, waters of Alaska, or is it fairly similar?
It's similar and different. You know, a big part of British Columbia was, you know, there's three major ecosystems that I paddled through, the Salish Sea and the Southern Reaches, and then most of British Columbia was a Great Bear Rainforest, which, you know, like up here, I'm paddling through a rainforest, so I expect it to be quite wet.
Mm-hmm.
But that was where I had some of the biggest challenges in British Columbia, some of the really steep-walled fjords and you know, extreme tidal differences and lots of brown bears. But, you know, Alaska, when I got into Alaska, things really seemed like they were changing for me, maybe because it was just the concept of, wow, I just paddled to Alaska and everything seemed brighter and bigger and sparklier and, you know, that sort of
right,
thing.
Right.
It was just I was on just such a natural high.
So let's talk about highs and lows then.
Yeah.
So what were some of the, maybe not lows, but like most challenging moments that you felt like, wow, that was a close one or that kind of thing?
Probably the biggest low was a place called Grenville Channel, about halfway through the British Columbia portion. And it was just a miserable stretch of weather, probably 5-6 days, just torrential downpour the entire time. And, you know, I'm in a wilderness setting. I'm camping, obviously. And gale force winds, just really just nasty conditions for a paddler. And I'm encountering a lot of territorial mama bears. And so I'm paddling these ridiculously long distances to avoid them because I'm not going
to
camp there.
Right.
So I would keep going and going and going like the Energizer Bunny until my hands were just basically raw and I'm hallucinating from doing these, you know, 40 mile days. And I came really, really close to throwing in the towel. I think it was the third or fourth night. It was extreme tidal differences, like 23, 24 foot high tides that would, they always show up. The highest of the high tides show up in the wee hours of the morning. And in a couple scenarios, because of the topography and the geography, my camp is up against, way back in the forest and up against these sheer cliff rock faces that go hundreds, if not thousands of feet straight up. So I can't get to higher ground. So those campsites were flooded in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And so it really kind of messed with my beauty sleep and my attitude. So that was definitely a low light.
When you say hallucinating, do you mean that, I mean, what, hearing things, seeing things, that kind of thing?
Yeah, or? It was like I was so exhausted and mildly hypothermic, you know, shivering, and I wasn't refueling my body. I was essentially paddling a marathon every day, the distance of a marathon, day after day after day. And these last few days I had done 30 and then 40 miles. And when you get hypothermic, you start making poor choices. And so I wasn't refueling my body. I'd seen so many bears that it was like every stump started looking like a bear.
Right.
And I knew that I was in trouble.
So what broke out of that? Did you just get a good stretch of weather? What happened?
Well, this is kind of my opening theme tonight at the talk, which is kind of fun. I basically relive that one night from that miserable night.
Yeah, I mean,
and it was my rage.
Don't give it away too much, maybe. But
no, it was essentially partly my ego.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, how's this going to play out? I'm going to have to call for the Coast Guard and abort the trip. So it was just my rage. I was screaming like bloody murder in the middle of nowhere in this forest where it's pouring rain. I'm all alone. And I'm just screaming at the top of my lungs. And that pressed a mental reset button for me. And I was like, okay, Susan, you've gotten yourself into this mess, you better figure a way out.
But here's the adventure staring at you.
Yeah,
right.
And I did. It was just like something clicked in my brain. I distinctly remember that where I was like, okay, so the tarp, after, you know, struggling with it for what seemed like an eternity, it magically cooperated, got the tent up, got out of my wet clothes, got some food in my belly, and I was just acting very methodically and slow and controlled, you know, in a really positive way, where before I was quite frantic. And so it was just rage, a life-giving, soul-shocking rage.
Wow. Well, that's a real epiphany.
It was.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
And then let's talk about some of the kind of hallmark areas that you went through. Were there areas that when you were planning the trip out, you knew, well, this one's, I mean, I always think of, for instance, I brought up the Wrangell Narrows, for instance, as an area that people famously know that when you go through there, it can get really hairy.
Yeah.
So what were some of those areas that you were sort of anticipating during the trip?
Where I might have problems, encounter problems.
Yeah.
I had several what I refer to as like crux moves that I knew could present some big problems to me. And so, let's see, crossings, all the big crossings challenged me in a big way. Queen Charlotte Strait, which is 18 miles of pretty much open water, and that faces pretty much the brunt of everything that the Pacific can and will dish out. Rosario Strait, Strait of Georgia, going around the very appropriately named Cape Caution, where I was storm-bound for 3 days with 30-foot seas. That's just totally open.
30-foot seas.
Yeah, nothing between me and Japan there. So I was happy to be, you know, shore-bound. And then, of course, Dixon Entrance, which loosely defines the British Columbia-Alaskan border, was just very big and ominous and just kept me on my toes.
Yeah.
So,
how did you stay stocked up as far as food and supplies and things like that?
And that was all part of the logistical preparation. Once I got this idea that I was going to paddle the Inside Passage by myself, I spent the better part of 10 months preparing, you know, physically getting myself into, like, tip-top shape. But logistically, the food, you know, I dehydrated a lot of my own food, and then I would have that all divvied up so that it would go in their respective resupply boxes to these six towns that I had picked along the way that were separated by 10 days to 2 weeks paddling time. So though I had a friend back home that would follow me on my spot satellite tracking device, so he always knew where I was on Google Earth, and then he would ship those boxes out at a specific time so they would arrive at the post offices in these towns, and they always beat me there, which was
ideal. Oh, that's great.
Ideal.
So that kind of worked like a charm.
Yeah, he knew how critical it was that these boxes arrived before I did.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, and so let's talk about some highlights.
Highlights.
Let's get away from the lowlights.
Yeah, absolutely. Most of the highlights were in Alaska for me. You know, I'd never seen glaciers before, icebergs, and I had a wonderful encounter. Oh, also with a super pod of orcas, killer whales, and humpbacks. I'd seen them for most of the route.
Right.
But particularly when I got into Alaska and Holcomb Bay, I'm trying to think of some of the big bays just south of here where I had these amazing encounters. And then, of course, you know, icebergs just floating everywhere, coming down from La Conte Glacier and just other areas. And my all-time favorite, actually my favorite campsite of the entire trip, was just 15 miles south of here at Slocum Inlet. And it was just, the sun had come out and it was calm and beautiful, and I had I could just about see Juneau up Gastineau Channel, and there's snow-capped peaks and whales out in that bay all night long. I had a little babbling brook, and there was wildflowers all around me. It was just like an idyllic setting.
Yeah.
And I'm just sitting there in my little soft camp chair, drinking a cup of hot cocoa or whatever, and watching whales, you know, play in front of me. I'm like, no, this is the dream.
Yeah. There you go.
The sun is shining. Life is good.
Right.
So it was definitely my happy place. And to this day, that's where I go when I need that, you know, mental or emotional timeout. I go to that campsite just south of here.
Right.
Be here in a day. There in a day.
What kind of boat did you have?
I paddled it's 18 feet 4 inches long and 21 inches wide, so pretty long and skinny, a Boreal design. It's a Canadian boat, Eastern Canada.
Fiberglass?
Kevlar, carbon Kevlar, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a Boreal design Labrador was the make and the model.
So is a boat pretty much designed for these kinds of long expedition type things? I mean,
the boat that I chose wasn't, a lot of people wouldn't classify it as an expedition boat per se. It was really long and skinny. For me, you know, in the hands of a skilled paddler, it's definitely very seaworthy and just tough as nails. But it's not an expedition boat per se. It didn't have a rudder. It was a skig. So, you know, a rudder, you just steer with your feet, which makes things a lot easier. There were times when I would have killed for a rudder on this trip. But the skig just deploys like a shark fin from the stern, and it helps with, you know, directional control.
Right.
But that's about it. And it was such a narrow boat that it was a challenge to pack, you know, everything that I would need to survive for up to 2 weeks. But, you know, I made it work.
Yeah, but allows for less drag and is a little bit faster and all those things.
I wanted a fast boat because I was going solo, and I'm just wired for speed and distance.
Yeah.
And at least I was at that time. So I chose that boat for that very reason.
Did you know you were going to write a book when you went on the journey, or how did that come about?
Never intended to write a book, no. I mean, I have a background in writing. My degree is in photojournalism. I've had a lot of my articles and photographs published, but, you know, never a book. And it was years later, after I completed the journey, that, you know, a lot of people would ask me, you know, when's the book coming out? And I'd always like, yeah, right. And then it just kind of occurred to me, well, maybe there is a story here. And I always joke that paddling to Alaska was the easy part. Writing the book and, and getting it edited and then finding a publisher and now promoting it has been an endurance event like none other.
Did you have a log that you kind of kept during the journey?
Yes, I kept a very extensive journal throughout the entire trip. I had these waterproof notebooks that I had stashed in those each resupply box, and I wrote a lot some days. And I also had a waterproof handheld voice recorder, so sometimes I would record epic moments. And I took almost 5,000 photos on the trip, so I documented it pretty extensively. Yeah.
So now you're out on a book tour.
I am. Yeah.
And so you kind of gone across the country and East Coast, West Coast,
all
everywhere
over
in between.
The place.
Yeah.
The journey continues. It's like every time I get to share this story with others, it's like I relive it.
Right.
And since the book came out about a year and a half ago, I've been, like you said, East Coast. I grew up in upstate New York, so I've got lots of connections there on the East Coast. Lived in Montana for 20 years. Did a lot of talks there, all up and down the Inside Passage, different communities like Juneau, Skagway, Ketchikan, speaking at towns like that.
Some of the kind of main things that people are really curious about when they meet you and ask you questions about your journey?
The most common questions are, well, like how you started. Why? Why on earth would you want to do and why solo? A lot of people want to know why I chose to go solo. And then, of course, especially if they're paddlers, they want to know how I prepared, you know, more specifics on that. And I touch on that in my slideshow tonight of how I prepared logistically, physically, mentally, emotionally. Other questions, you know, of course, everybody wants to know how long did it take you, how many miles was it, what were your biggest fears and challenges?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the thing that everyone thinks about if they have ever contemplated this is like, you know, almost could you get through it? It'd be so scary.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the thing that I think of, like
the fear.
A solo journey out in the wilderness. You've got no one but yourself to count on.
Mm-hmm.
And if things just kind of go in the right combination of wrong, that can be it.
Mm-hmm.
So, so staring that in the face, and I mean, that's a real step.
Yeah, right? And for me, that was a matter of just being as prepared as I possibly could. So, you know, being at least physically and logistically prepared, that helped me feel more mentally and emotionally prepared. I'm just such a kind of a methodical, pragmatic person that just helped me feel more centered going into it. And I knew that I had a great kayak, and, you know, the best of all the gear was top notch. I was in great shape. I was very skilled. I've been paddling for 25 years. So, you know, I felt like I was ready for this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I spent 10 months preparing for it. But the whole fear issue, there really is an underlying current of fear flowing through my book. And sometimes I think it's like the whole book is a metaphor on fear. And I talk a lot in a chapter entitled Fear Stuck Still about the fears that I really did experience as a woman paddling solo, and how I had to many times acknowledge those fears, and other times I had to, like, compartmentalize them and put them in a box. Otherwise, I would never get off the beach.
Yeah.
So it's not so much about just being stoic and courageous. It's just about
coping
moving forward.
Mechanisms or figuring out ways to get through it. Yeah.
Yeah, and you really don't know until you're put in that position.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's fascinating talking to you. Thanks so much for sharing part of your story. You're going to be sharing more of it tonight at the Friday Fireside Lecture out at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. So the two shows are at 6:30 and 8 o'clock, and I always remind people to get there early.
Yes.
Because this will be a standing room only talk, I'm sure.
We hope so.
Your book is Inside, One Woman's Journey Through the Inside Passage.
Yes.
and available everywhere, I'm guessing, right?
Yes, and actually, we'll ironically have a stack of them at the event tonight.
Not ironic at all. That's just good business.
Anne Marie with Discovery Southeast will be there representing the book.
Oh,
so
that's
you
great.
Bet you can get a signed copy there tonight, and Hearthside Books carries it here locally. And, of course, all the regular online sources, electronic as well.
That's great. Well, Susan Conrad, thanks so much for coming in and talking to us about it. And have a great journey.
Thank you.
Continued journey.
Thank you, Andy.
Okay, thank you. Here's Bird Note coming up next.
This is Bird Note. Many scientists believe that the demise of the dinosaurs began when an asteroid struck the Earth 66 million years ago. Near what is now Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. In the nuclear winter-like conditions that followed, some dinosaurs survived, and among them were the early ancestors of birds. These gave rise to what's been called the Big Bang of bird evolution. Birds underwent an extraordinary diversification over 5 to 10 million years. Nearly 95% of the 10,000-plus bird species now flying, swimming, and walking on Earth came out of this evolutionary moment. Recently, a huge international research team sequenced the full genomes of 45 birds of diverse lineages. The group used the DNA data to rewrite avian genealogy. Their conclusions were published in December 2014. One other finding from this prodigious data crunching? The common ancestor of today's birds, among them warblers, parrots, woodpeckers, falcons, and owls, was an apex predator, a top-of-the-food-chain carnivore. So, even a seed-eating cardinal has something like Tyrannosaurus rex in its family tree. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Bird Note listeners are taking a once-in-a-lifetime journey to the Galapagos, and you can join us in July 2018. Trip details and more at birdnote.org.
Support for KTO comes from listeners like you and from Wild Oven, delivering freshly baked bread to Foodland, Super Bear, and Rainbow Foods. Wild Oven, baking handmade organic sourdough in Juneau. More information at facebook.com/wildoven.
Join us for a public viewing of the documentary Inside Out, Leaving Prison Behind. The film follows three individuals as they're released from prison and struggle to rebuild their lives on the outside. Following the 30-minute screening, we'll have a panel discussion with experts in the field of recovery, incarceration, and reentry. Admission is free at 360 in the KTOO building on Wednesday, March 14th at 5:30 p.m.
And we're back in the studios here, and I'm joined with Ben Brown. Ben, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Andy. Good to be here, as always.
Ben from the Juneau Arts and Humanities Council, and you, of course, also hear him as a sometimes host here on Juneau Afternoon. Ben, you're here to talk a little bit about a related subject to the public service announcement we just heard. It's about the In-N-Out Success In-N-Out program. So tell
Success
me a little bit about
Inside and Out. Yes,
Inside and Out.
Well,
sorry.
As you know, Andy, I'm also an attorney, a member of the Alaska Bar Association, although I'm no longer lucky enough to have clients in the criminal defense context. I certainly did for many years. And that's when I first got involved with Success Inside and Out, when I was an associate attorney, actually, at Baxter, Bruce, and Sullivan. So it basically is a program at Lemon Creek Correctional Center that is put on by a whole group of people, starting with the Alaska court system, Lemon Creek Correctional Center, the State Department of Corrections, and then a lot of other interested parties from the Department of Law, Gastineau Human Services, and others who are involved in making sure that when people have served their sentences and it's time for them to reintegrate into society, much like that film is focusing on, it's not easy for them to do. And they don't have the resources, either financial resources or sometimes intangible resources, to be able to step back outside a correctional facility and find a place to live and find a job and do the things that they need, not to end up back inside, because mm-hmm. that's not what anyone wants. You know, the revolving door, recidivism, these are social problems of which people are keenly aware. And Success Inside and Out is kind of a grassroots effort to stop that problem before it starts again.
So there's certain patterns that can develop in people's lives that make them, you know, get them to the point where they're incarcerated to begin with. breaking those patterns when they come back out is a big part of it, I would think.
Exactly. And so success inside and out, you know, and there have been legislative attempts, which we don't need to take the time to discuss right now. And society as a whole across our nation has been dealing with the problem of recidivism. But success inside and out is just a very local, hands-on, one-day seminar that takes presents an opportunity to people at Lemon Creek who are going to be released in the near future and says, look, we're going to spend the day, we're going to have some people come to the prison, and they're going to present to you a whole host of ideas about things you should be thinking about before you get out, such as, what are you going to try to do to get a job? How would you go about doing that? Do you have a resume? Do you have any clothes that you could wear to an interview? Where might you like to work? Where is it realistic to think that you're going to be able to work? Similarly, we want employers to realize that people who have served their sentences are ready to reenter and deserve a second chance. And so we want employers to be open-minded to the fact that people who do want to put their lives back together can really be as good as anyone else, if not better, as potential employees.
That seems like something that probably is can be a big roadblock.
Absolutely. Housing can be a big problem.
Yeah.
Substance abuse. You know, people have been unable, for the most part, to abuse substances when they've been incarcerated. But when they come back out, those temptations may exist again. So for anyone who's facing that kind of a problem, getting them in touch with whatever they need to stay sober, if that's the choice they've made for themselves, whether that's Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous, whether it's a faith-based program, you know, finding some sort of higher power that, whether or not they're doing 12 steps, helps them kind of keep on the path they want to keep on. Certainly, the need to just chart a path is the most important thing. You know,
have some sort of plan.
Exactly.
Have some sort of, yeah.
You know, you could be marking with little hash marks on the wall of your cell, and then that day comes, and then if you're not prepared for it, it's not going to go as well as if you have prepared for it, is what the studies have shown. And so we're really fortunate to have a lot of support from the legal community here in town, and that's one of my main role this year. Has been raising funds for the project. So many law firms in town have been very generous. Faulkner Banfield, Baxter Bruce and Sullivan, Kevin Higgins, Simpson Tellinghast have all made significant financial donations to defray some of the costs, because the day is also supposed to be fun. And so in years past, Colette Costa has gone and performed some musical numbers for the inmates, which obviously has to be quite a highlight.
Sure.
Compared to the usual routine inside Lemon Creek.
Right.
And then there's food, you know. So there's pizzas from Bullwinkle's and some sandwiches from Subway. So different food than they are normally able to eat when they're at Lemon Creek.
Yeah.
Hayden Garrison at Creative Sources donated calendars for each of the participants in the Success and Inside Out seminar, because that's a physical thing that they can use and say, wow, on this day I'm going to become a free man or a free woman. What do I want to do? This is the first day of the rest of my life. And so I'm very grateful to Hayden for providing those again, because, again, a daily planner is something you maybe take for granted if you're not in prison. It's something people don't have inside.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a real clear physical way to look forward and be thinking, what do I want to do in a week? What do I want to be doing in 6 months? What do I want to be doing in a year? So it's a program that does not exist in every correctional facility across the state. Lemon Creek's been doing it for a number of years. And one thing I really want to highlight is Lieutenant Governor Byron Mulott is actually going to go and spend some time talking to the inmates. I have not actually gone and participated at Lemon Creek for a number of years, but I think it was 3 years ago I went, and I got to listen to him talk. And he was just very candid and inspiring to all of the inmates. He was just basically said, look, I'm your lieutenant governor, but I want you to succeed. I don't want to see you back in here. And so I think it's great that he's willing to, you know, take time out of his schedule to go and be a voice of inspiration. But it really is a community effort. The Juneau Reentry Coalition's very much involved. Terry Tibbett, on behalf of the Mental Health Board and the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. Judge Swanson is one of our district court judges here in town. And just all these different groups have come together to make it what it is. And, again, it's a one-day seminar. It's not going to solve the whole problem. But it's just encouraging to see that people are caring about people on the inside, mm-hmm. because they want them to be accepted and have every chance to succeed when they get back out.
Yeah, it's so easy to forget about the folks that are there, and the fact that when the idea is to have some recuperation and to have them obviously rejoin society. So a great program, yeah.
And I can tell you, I remember back when I did have criminal defense clients. Nothing makes you happier than seeing a client who's had troubles like that, you know, 6 months or a year down the road, and they've got a job and they're working somewhere there, and they have their act together. You're like, wow, that I like being an attorney. There are rewards that are
right.
Not just monetary for this work. Similarly, if you have clients that you've helped get a good deal and they reoffend, that really is dispiriting. So and that's from the perspective of being an advocate for an individual person. But all of us in society should share that same goal that people are not going back in and there isn't a revolving door and people are choosing to make things happen in their lives that are better for them and better for everyone else.
All right, great. Well, it's the Success Inside and Out program. Ben, thanks so much for telling us about anything else you want to cover on that. And I'm going to keep you around. We're going to listen to a little music. I'm going to keep you around and have you switch hats and go back to the Juno Arts and Humanities Council. We'll talk about the Quivey sisters.
Yeah, I just want to say thanks to, again, all the folks I've mentioned previously, the law firms and the individuals who provided their time and monetary support for Success Inside and Out. It's going to be taking place tomorrow at Lemon Creek Correctional Center. And I hope it goes really well. And, you know, there may be some folks listening who have a loved one who is inside there right now that they go and visit. So just to be thinking about how that person's going to be out soon and what you can do to help them succeed.
All right. Thanks, Ben. Taste of the Quivey sisters there. Ben Brown is still here. I've kept him on.
Yes, indeed.
About this really cool trio.
Trio of sisters, and they are from Grand Prairie, Texas, and they are playing in Anchorage tomorrow night, and then we're lucky enough to have them flying down to join us for a concert on Sunday night out at Thunder Mountain High School, and there are still tickets available at jahc.org or 586-2787, or if you want to swing by the Jack. We'd be happy to sell you some tickets, but they're just really animated fiddlers. I believe they did an interview yesterday afternoon telephonically, and I think it's just great they're coming to Alaska. It's a little bit different than some of the other concerts that the Arts Council has presented this year, and it's a different venue. We're reaching out to our folks, our friends in the Valley, so they don't have to drive all the way downtown for a show. And I think it's going to be a good time for everyone who's there.
Yeah, sounds great. Okay, so there's also, we wanted to discuss, there's a community discussion happening tonight.
Yes. After Wearable Art a few weeks ago, there was some concern raised about one of the pieces. And so the Arts Council Board of Trustees has chosen to try to have a series of community conversations about cultural sensitivity. And just, I think, so people are informed about knowing what the choices that they make artistically might do to other people around them. Certainly, it's not about censorship, but it's about mindfulness, I think. And so this community conversation on cultural appropriation this evening is going to be moderated by some folks from the University of Alaska Southeast who have some expertise in this area. And it is open to the community. It'll be from 5:30 to 7 at the Jack. It's a potluck. And so people are going to be able to bring a dish and share that. And the moderators are going to try to encourage people to have a open, candid conversation about, I guess, one thing people, you know, are not really familiar with the concept of what cultural appropriation is. And so a lot of people have said to me, wow, I'd never heard of that before. And they've gone online and they've done some research about it. One of the first examples of cultural appropriation was when the English started wearing tartans in the 19th century. It became fashionable. And, of course, people in Scotland thought, well, why are you wanting to do this now? You know, we've actually warred with you centuries ago. We were literally killing one another. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean to trivialize it, but so it means different things to different people. And I think it would be fair to say that this conversation this evening is very much a beginning. And certainly it's not going to conclude anything or wrap anything up or change anyone's practices overnight. It's going to be the beginning of a conversation, and it's probably more about heightening awareness than anything else at this point.
Yeah, and I think that there's been some, hotly expressed kind of emotions and feelings on both sides, but I also think it's really a healthy discussion to have for the community to have, It's,
It is happening. So yeah. Whether or not you or I would like it to be happening, it is happening. And if it weren't happening, the emotions that have led to its happening would just be bottled up. So frankly, if people, emotions aren't facts. You can't tell somebody that they're right or wrong for feeling the way that they feel. I don't think. You can explain to them that you'd understand why they feel that way, and then they can try to explain to you why they feel that way, and hopefully that conversation is good for people on both sides. So I certainly think we will have a variety of points of view in the main hall at the Jack this evening. I'd be surprised if we didn't. And the conversation is happening, and I think it has to happen, and I think it's going to continue to have to happen. We certainly want there to be a wearable art next year. There will be a wearable art next year. The theme is going to be turbulence. And we want people to participate, and we hope that people will continue to participate. Art is guaranteed to upset people some of the time. It's guaranteed to offend people some of the time. It is guaranteed to make them happy and sometimes make them sad and make them angry. That's what art does. But that stated, we don't have to go into it unintentionally causing pain for other people. That shouldn't really be anyone's intent, and I don't think it was in the context of what happened. But I don't know. I'm not the artist who created mm-hmm. the piece. I'm not the person who responded to the way that piece was presented. Mm-hmm. I was working the front table selling raffle tickets, to be quite honest. So I heard about a lot of it second or third hand. But that stated, I can tell you the organization where I work, the Arts and Humanities Council, is committed to having an artistically and culturally vibrant community, and also wants to make sure that people are aware of the effect of the choices that they make.
Yeah, so that's starts at 5:30 tonight?
5:30 to 7 in the main hall at the Jack, and again, there's some professional facilitators. There's a thorough description of it on our Facebook page, and also at jahc.org on the website. And if people do have questions, they can call 586-2787. People are busily getting ready for it over there. So at this point, I would say, instead of calling and telling us your opinion on the phone, just join us tonight in the main hall, and we can have a conversation about it.
And the Quibi Sisters tomorrow?
No, the Quibi Sisters are tomorrow in Anchorage. So if you're going to be in Anchorage tomorrow, but there will be Sunday night at Thunder Mountain High School. And again, plenty of tickets still available. Go online to jahc.org or call 586-2787. Or if you're coming for the community conversation tonight and you want to get Quibi Sisters tickets, you can accomplish all those worthy goals in one fell swoop by visiting the Jack.
Ben Brown, thanks so much for letting us know about all these programs that you're involved in.
My pleasure, as always, Andy. Thank you very much, and I wish you all the best for a great weekend.
Okay, thank you.
I'm feeling rough.
It's a little bit of pandemonium here in the studio, I'll be honest. How you guys doing?
Good.
You guys doing good?
Yeah.
All right.
Good.
We got a bunch of students here from Gastineau Elementary School. So I'm just going to go through and ask you guys to each introduce yourselves. So what's your name?
Dylan.
Caden.
Hazel.
Hazel, you went out of turn.
Hazel.
Lydia, okay. So you guys took on a really interesting kind of problem, right?
Yeah.
How did you guys find out about this problem? What would you say the problem was that you were trying to solve? Hazel, I'll talk to Hazel. Yes.
Plastic straws in the ocean.
Plastic straws in the ocean. So we all have used plastic straws, and you don't sort of think about where do they go after we use them, right? So how do they end up in the ocean? Who knows how they... A lot of paper rustling over there. How do they end up in the ocean? Do you know?
Like, they... people, like, litter plastic.
Uh-huh.
And then, when the wind comes, it blows into the ocean.
Sure, that's one way it can happen. I think sometimes trash is just taken in big, huge... you know, kind of bundles and taken out way out into the ocean and dumped in the ocean too, right? Yeah.
And then run down trains in New York that are just thrown into the ocean.
Right. So then, if a plastic straw gets in the ocean, then what happens to it?
It can
affect marine life.
Yeah. Because, a sea turtle might swallow it.
Sea turtles, they go after them, they think they're food or something?
Plastic bags, especially.
Wash up on the shore to make, a giant garbage beach.
Is
that right? They make a big garbage beach?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it washes up on shore.
Ocean currents.
There's actually a video of a sea turtle in the sky pulling a straw out of its nose.
Yeah. And, Crash Island. Some people might have heard about that.
Okay.
It's a huge island.
Made of trash. You can, walk on the
you
ocean,
can actually
because
walk.
There's so much
there's
trash.
There's a place in Africa where there's, this river.
Uh-huh.
And you can walk on it. There's so much trash in it.
So, plastic straws are bad. They end up in the ocean. Sea turtles and other creatures can eat them. They end up either in their stomachs or they can even end up in their noses and stuff like that. It's awful. So what was the solution that you guys came up with?
Switch your straw to paper, but they are a little more expensive, 3 cents more. So if you do a restaurant, you can ask them if they want a straw first before you give them a straw.
So there's two things, right? Number one, maybe you don't even need a straw at all, right?
Yeah.
You can probably drink a drink without a straw usually, right?
Yeah.
That's one thing. Yes. Well, unless you don't drink it all at once, right? You can sip it, genteelly. Like gentlemen and ladies, right? We sip our drinks.
Yeah.
Or if you really have a drink, like these drinks that Mark from Copa just brought over here, which we're going to try in a minute, which are kind of like milkshakey float kind of things, then you kind of maybe want a straw. Then you can use a paper straw.
Yeah.
We actually have some right over there.
We're going to have some?
Yeah.
Should we have some?
Right there.
Yeah.
Just this one?
Some.
Which one should we try?
The pink one.
The pink one.
Yeah.
Mark, what's in the pink one?
That's a rhubarb sherbet freeze.
All right, now here we are. These aardvark.
Yes.
Original paper.
There was
aardvark paper straw.
And their mascot was
this is
the mascot.
Soda one. This one.
So there's a couple of different kinds I got here. This one I'm holding one that's kind of a thick one, right? Which is like a milkshake straw. And then this is like a soda straw. Does this have the little thing that you can bend? It's just a thinner one, right? And so this is for sodas. And
plastic straws don't have design.
They're fun, right? They look they have these great candy stripe kind of looks like
plastic straws are really solid color.
Candy cane.
So how did you guys find out about aardvark straws?
Yeah.
How did you find out?
We looked on websites, Safari we looked up plastic
straws.
Paper straws.
Yeah.
With the paper straws.
I mean paper straw sellers.
And then talk to businesses in town about?
Yeah, we've got 5 restaurants.
What are the restaurants? I'm going to ask Hazel. What are the restaurants?
Copa, Rainbow Foods, Gonzo,
What?
Malaga Distillery. Okay.
Malaga Distillery. Israel's Bistro.
That's five. Yeah. Those are all great places, too. They make delicious stuff. Okay. Here it is. I'm poking the straw into, went through the plastic part of the cup very well. No problem there. It is now going through the whipped cream on top successfully, and it has reached the bottom of the drink. Very good. I'm going to now attempt to drink this delicious drink out of a paper straw, live on the air here. Are we all ready?
Yeah.
Do you think I can do it?
Yeah.
All right. Here we go. It worked! It worked! Yeah. The paper straws work! Oh, that is exciting. That's really good, by the way.
Rhubarb sherbet and soda water.
That's available over at Copa. Ask for it.
That's limited edition.
Not yet. Oh, not yet. No. It's not even available yet.
Not yet.
Oh, see? This is. I'm going to keep this one for myself. You want some of this?
Yeah.
All right, here. Everyone gets a straw. You get a straw. Pass it around over there. There you go.
Okay, wait, I
don't. Oh, okay. There's the straws. I'm keeping one. I'm keeping one because I'm going to try this other one. What's this other one?
That is the Alaska Probiotics Kombucha Float.
Kombucha Float from Alaska Probiotics.
With vanilla bean ice cream.
That's what I like. I like when you bring over the ice cream. Right? There you go. So we got kombucha with ice cream float happening here. I'm going to try to poke the paper straw through the ice cream. I've done it. Oh, that's good, too. That kombucha is great. Roasted dandelion ginger. Wow, that's delicious. All right, so. So what's your hope? Are you guys gonna continue to talk to more restaurants in town? What's your hope about getting more and more people to use paper straws?
It will stop polluting the ocean.
Yes, but do you think more restaurants in town might adopt this idea? Are you going to talk to more people?
Yeah.
You are?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Really?
Yeah.
Are you really?
We're going to talk to more restaurants.
Okay, very good. And also, I think it would just be lots of restaurants, people listening right now, people who are customers at restaurants can just become more aware. Right? About plastic straws and about...
Maybe just ask them if they want a straw before they get one.
Right. Or you can tell your server, no straw, please.
Yeah.
Right? And there'll be less straws then, that way. Right? What are other ways that you can think of that can keep people from using plastic straws in everyday life?
They could visit website at www.switchyourstraw.weebly.com.
Switcherstraw.weebly.com.
They could get some reusable metal straws from some...
They make those?
Yeah, they do.
And metal straws?
With a little cleaner.
That's really? A little, like, kind of little pipe cleaner thing that you mm-hmm. get put in there? Oh, that's kind of cool.
You can also see some videos on www.switcherstraw.weebly.com.
What are the videos of?
How plastic affects the ocean and marine life.
So it sort of shows that island you were talking about and some of
Crash
that stuff.
Island
yeah.
That stuff.
Yeah. It's important because we live on the ocean, right? That's one thing that's really important, right? And we eat fish that comes from the ocean and we get to go out and kayak and go on boats and all that kind of stuff.
Oh.
So it feels like maybe we should set the example for other communities, right? Because we benefit from that beautiful ocean every single day, right? Well, it's really awesome that you guys took up the charge and decided that this was something you could take on. How did you decide? Because a lot of times kids, I think, are like your kids, you're in elementary school, you kind of might think, well, I'm a kid in elementary school. Maybe I can't help make this change. What made you think, I'm going to go out there and actually change some of this?
Because we saw marine life struggling.
Lego Robotics also helped.
How did Lego Robotics help?
Well, because we did have
water.
To do something.
Is that water?
Right. Yeah, that was the competition.
And we kind of had to do something. And then once we started, we thought we could finish it.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Well, it's really cool. So you got inspired a little bit by Lego Robotics.
Yep.
You got inspired by seeing these kind of awful videos, right, that show all this terrible stuff.
There's also this sea turtle that had a plastic soda ring around its body.
Oh, a ring around the body.
When it was a baby. Mm-hmm. And then it grew to huge, it had like 7 feet long.
It had a really
and it had a ring around its stomach, so it was like skinny.
It couldn't digest anything.
It couldn't die. Yeah. It couldn't eat, so it died.
Oh, that's sad. So plastic straws is one thing, but maybe being mindful about all these other plastic things that we use all the time.
You can cut your rings when you throw them in the garbage so it won't get around the...
Exactly. Yeah. I always do that. I hope it helps. You know? You hope those things help, right?
Yeah.
I mean, but using plastic in general maybe is something to think about a lot, right? Try to maybe select products that aren't using those kinds of plastic rings and that kind of thing and... You know, be mindful of that. Packaging that people use for stuff can have less plastic. That stuff's all important to think about, right?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's really great that you guys are thinking about this at a really young age and inspiring other people to think about it as well. Mm-hmm. What's been the funnest part of this project for you?
Probably the Lego robotics.
Lego robotics and getting ice cream from Copa.
Yeah, okay. Definitely the ice cream.
At the end of Lego robotics competition, we ended up in 25th place with 0 points, but...
Yeah.
What happened?
Our robot got stepped on.
Our robot got stepped on.
The engines weren't exactly the same.
Yeah, and...
Yeah, someone stepped on it, so we had to fix it, like... And it was in a wonky position.
In, like, 8 minutes.
And that
like 8 minutes
stinks.
Somebody
oh,
in.
Man. You had great plans, and then an accident just happened and took you out of it.
In practices, it worked, like, 10 times, but then...
The wood,
the
they didn't have that nice, like, slick
just,
edges.
Just wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
It was a little wonky from being stepped on, maybe?
The tables were different from...
Oh,
yeah, they had the wood, like, edges, so it got stuck on the edge.
And then it got stuck on the edges, and then we lost all of our matches.
Well, you've turned that around and turned into something incredibly positive. I want to thank you guys for coming in and telling me about this. What's the name of the website one more time?
www.switchyourstraw.weebly.com.
Switchyourstraw.weebly.com. That's it. It's on this?
Yeah.
Okay. Very good. It's on there. All right. Well, thanks again, you guys. Thanks for doing this. Really appreciate it. Thanks for taking this on as a project and doing at least the part that you can do to make the world better, right? And thanks to the local restaurants and organizations and folks that have helped this and taken up the charge as well, including Copa. Mark, thanks so much for the delicious ice cream and floats and kombucha and all that stuff you brought in as well. It tastes great out of a paper straw. I think it's better out of a paper straw.
Yeah, it's
delicious.
Cleaner.
Yes, it's cleaner. It's better for everyone, better for the environment. Thanks, you guys. Appreciate it so much. Okay.
Thank you. You're welcome.
And that's it for a Juno afternoon for today. I want to thank those kids from Gaston Elementary School. Awesome that they're doing their part. Switchyourstraw.weebly.com is the website. You can see everything they've been doing. The Inside and Out program, Success Inside and Out, happening tomorrow at Lemon Creek. And then there's a community discussion happening over at the Jack tonight about the cultural appropriation issue, and that's happening from 5:30 to 7 o'clock tonight. It's a potluck, so bring something. And then Susan Conrad speaking tonight at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center on her solo kayaking trip in the Inside Passage. Fascinating to talk to her today. I want to thank her for coming by and telling us all about it. And you can hear her tonight at 6:30 and again at 8 o'clock during her lecture out at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. I'm Andy Klein. Thanks so much for joining me today for a Juno afternoon. That's it, and have a great weekend. Oh, and thanks to Copa, too. Mark Wheeler at Copa for bringing in that great ice cream.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay.